I think every encounter with a patient is a potential rehumanizing experience, and also for me as a therapist. Because when we are slowly experiencing this kind of positive emotion in the therapy, especially when it comes to turning points, where the patient suddenly realizes that it is possible to trust another human being, that's a really remarkable experience with these patients who have all reasons to not believe that it's possible to trust other people, who have been disappointed, who have been failed so many times and maltreated so many times. So that is a rehumanizing experience that happens, I think, between the therapist and the patient. It's really, I think that's the best way to describe the process of positive outcome of this type of psychoanalytic therapy. Because they've been dehumanized in so many ways and to such a degree that it's, for some of them, it's a wonder that they have normal feelings left.
Welcome to the Psychoanalysis On and Off the Couch podcast. For the past few years, we've been speaking with analysts from around the world who've been applying their analytic way of thinking, not only to their offices, but also off the couch, in venues external to their consulting rooms. We've spoken to analysts who work in hospitals, in prisons, in community health centers, in refugee clinics, just to name a few. We've also detoured, of course, during COVID. We've spoken with analysts again from around the world to learn from our communities how they, their patients, and the analytic community in general have been dealing with this crisis. And hopefully, the worst is over, and we can return to our main focus. We can return to speaking to analysts who are bringing their skills to people who otherwise would never see the inside of an analyst's office. In addition to that, we're speaking with the elders of our field, people who have been practicing this craft for 40 and 50, sometimes longer years, to learn from them what they have to teach us, not only about this piece of history that we're all living through, but their reflections on our field. Please visit us at our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can leave a comment, where you can subscribe. I hope you find these conversations thoughtful and meaningful, and I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Sverre Varvan. Dr. Varvan is a training analyst at the Norwegian Psychoanalytic Society, and he is a professor emeritus at the Oslo Metropolitan University. Dr. Varvan has been working in the area of traumatized refugees for more than 30 years. And as you will hear, his approach has been to understand the individual deeply, to share in that experience in the clinical work, and also to be a student of and an appreciator of the role of culture and community to both contribute to difficulties and potentially contribute to rehumanization of the individuals. He has done human rights work as chair of the Norwegian Medical Association's Committee on Human Rights in the Balkans, in Turkey, and in China. He also shares with us a bit about his own personal history and what has brought him to this work. I found it a privilege to not only immerse myself in his work, and his recent book is called Psychoanalysis in Social and Cultural Settings, Upheavals and Resilience, an exquisite example of the phrase psychoanalysis, both on and off the couch. And for those who are interested, he will be a keynote speaker at the IPA meetings in 2023 in July in Cartagena, Colombia. And it will be a privilege to hear him speak there as well. I hope you find meaning, as I did, in my conversation with Dr. Sverre Varvan. Sfera, welcome to the podcast. I'm so glad to have you here. For the past 30 years, you have been a student of, a researcher in, and a clinician for those individuals who've been overwhelmed by trauma. And for me, what's unique about your contribution is that you, on the one hand, focus on the internal life of the individual with a special appreciation of how they often suffer from a relative loss of their meaning-making and synthetic capacities. But in addition to doing that, you also are attentive to the role of the culture at large and how it can either support or make more difficult the redevelopment of that meaning-making synthetic capacities. And I thought the best way we can communicate this work of yours is by focusing on its clinical application. And this will come from your recent book entitled Psychoanalysis in Social and Cultural Settings, Upheavals and Resilience, where you speak both on theory concerning individual mental development and how it's impacted by trauma and the role of culture. And before I invite you to tell us about the case of Hassan, I'd like to read a few sentences that lays out the challenges of this clinical work. You write, quote, "The analyst, when taking on the task of treating such traumatized patients, inevitably becomes involved in the not symbolized, fragmentary, and as a rule, strongly affective scenarios related to the patient's traumatic experiences. This happens from the first encounter with the patient and is mostly expressed in the nonverbal interaction between the patient and the analyst. It may take a long time before these manifestations may be given a narrative form that in meaningful ways relates to traumatic and pre-traumatic experiences. And it implies hard and painful emotional work from the patient and also from the analyst to achieve this end." Tell us about Hassan.
Well, Hassan, he came from Middle Eastern country, and he came to Norway in his late 20s. He had experienced quite a lot in his lifetime, and his experiences were highly affected by the social political context in that area. He was a nice young man, quite proud, but quite disillusioned when I met him. And he was heavily tormented by constantly experiencing in his nightmares, but also in daily life, hallucinations of people that were persecuting him, wanting to kill him. He was at times quite convinced that at any time he could be killed by someone. And his experience was difficult also when he was a child and a youngster. He was came from a clan in the area where he was designated to be the leader of the clan. But this made him feel quite uncomfortable in relation to comrades and made also his relation to father quite difficult. He was looking up to father, idealizing father, but also quite afraid of father, that he might be caught in doing something wrong and so on. And then upheavals happened in his regions. And his group were persecuted. Many were arrested and killed. His father was executed as a designated person who was against the regime. And his brother also disappeared under difficult circumstances, probably killed. And his family was kind of dissolved in that situation, in that experience. And then he went to the university, and he was there designated as an opponent to the regime, and his fiancée was then arrested because of her relation to him. She was tortured and raped, and later she took her own life. And he had so much guilt in relation to this. It was a very difficult feeling of extreme guilt, but also of strong aggression towards the regime, who could do things like this. And he himself was arrested several times and tortured. He told gradually in the treatment about his torture experiences. Came in bits and fragments. It's very difficult to find the coherent pictures, but what appeared was almost intolerable to listen to. It was so serious.
And a challenge to read, I might add. I found listening to his history, his torture, traumatic history, to be a very difficult to read. And when you said, oh, he seemed like a nice man, when you said, I can picture him putting it together in this social way, but the abuse, physical to him, to his family, to his girlfriend, seemed just overwhelming. And I'm struggling to imagine what it would be like to sit there and be so intimately involved with these stories.
Yes. And that was the major difficulty. It is so difficult to try to put yourself in the place of the patient, which is our task as analysts, and to try to imagine what it would be to experience the loss of your fiancé or your wife in such a situation. And also this, what haunted him later on very much was these mock executions. And they were terrible in all ways. He were taken together with other mates or friends or whatever in the prison and put on a line with the rope around the neck. And all the other were killed, and he didn't. He was not. So this, of course, was paralyzing in so many ways.
And if I were in your seat listening to someone in front of me recounting this, not only would I feel, I don't know quite what the word is, how I would struggle to try, as you say, to put myself in his position, but I would also be thinking that this is going to play out between us in some fashion. And I would be shaken in anticipating that for his sake and for my sake.
No. I think that's very important because these stories was, when telling it, it was also, they were also filled with aggression towards everyone and also in the transference. So it hit me really strong. And it was very clear that he had to put his aggression somewhere, by telling me these stories were a way to dispose of his aggression. I was hit, and I'm sure he could see in my face, in the way I was in the session, that I was hit as well. So that was really an important part of the process, I think, that I had to endure in this way a bit of what he had experienced. So what was interesting was that what filled the therapy was very much his experience of being persecuted in exile, and all the frightening stories about being followed, being afraid of be killed, and so on. He kept for a long time a kind of idealized story about his childhood, which after a while became more realistic in a way. And then he had, in the beginning, very short periods where he could feel kind of like an ordinary person, living in exile, living in an apartment, going to the shop and buy food or whatever. This was this last experiential part of him that kind of grew during the therapy. And this, of course, was something that made me endure as well, that it was really possible for him to grow in this from this the dialogues that we had together.
Did you have a sense that he appreciated your appreciation of his growth and that you sort of grew together and that was sort of what facilitated his growth? I'm focusing on what it is you felt you two did that enabled him to have these periods of time where he felt like a regular person, if you will.
Well, I think that he was very sensitive in a way on my reactions, and I sensed that he was following me very closely and seeing how I reacted and how my mental state was. And of course, my mental state was ups and down for everyone. Mm-hmm. But I think he really appreciated when he gradually achieved a more normal life. Mm-hmm. He even got a girlfriend and he married. And he at last, after therapy, he got a child as well. So that was really a great pleasure for me. And when we talked, he could see that that I was it was doing me good as well, I think.
Uh-huh. That's something that I and perhaps many listeners are familiar with patients who have had abuse in childhood, that when we see them, they are exquisitely attuned to what they imagine to be our affective states, as they needed to be attuned to that as children. But we're talking about later trauma, not childhood trauma. And I'm interested to learn that that may be similar as well.
Well, it's both different and similar.
Can you share with us some of the challenging enactments?
What we have experienced and also shown in the research states that these later serious trauma, they evoke earlier difficulties and earlier childhood traumas. And that these childhood traumas, which may not be noticed, they are more decisive for how it works out later, even after wars and torture and so on. So I think I always pay attention to early childhood, even if there has not been obvious traumatic situations. In Hassan's life, there was difficult situation. It was hardships. It was difficult relation to father and so on. But it was not obvious that it was a traumatic situation like childhood abuse and so on. But it plays in all the time in how they experience later trauma and also what happens after trauma. And one theme in Hassan was his experience from childhood that he was very much alone. Nobody supported him in his difficulties. And this was exactly the same experience he felt in exile, that he was alone. Nobody was supporting him. And he experienced this negligence of his life, in his life.
So we really have three pillars that either facilitate or get in the way of healthy functioning, if you will. That is the nature of the trauma, the nature of the community response to trauma, and also the predisposing character from early childhood and how that allows you to tolerate feeling overwhelmed.
Yes, yes. I was thinking that the context or the surroundings response to the traumatized person is really important. And as we know, for many of the exiled person, the refugees, they are not very welcomed in society, in the society they come to. And this anti-refugee movement and so on and so forth. And they are sensitive, very sensitive to being rejected, of course. And they are also projecting a lot of their own problems onto others. So it's a very difficult balance, so to speak. But it's important to remember that many of them has experienced that their own culture from where they come has been quite heavily destroyed and attacked. And we see this, of course, not now in Ukraine, but in Middle East, the Yazidi people and so on. It has been not only an attempt to kill people, to destroy cities, but is it attempts to destroy the culture, the cultural background, which can give meaning to existence. So it's really a very difficult task being in exile and trying to organize a life where you can try to establish meaning of your personal experience. So I think that it is so complicated.
That's that interface between the cultural meaning and the individual meaning. And how do you address the cultural issues? Is it just speaking of it, or your understanding of it with them, or your providing a dyadic relationship that provides meaning? How do you address that?
In the therapeutic situation, I am quite sensitive to how they behave in the room, which reflects very much how they are, what kind of culture they bring with them for being in a relation. So it's a kind of nonverbal choreography that has to do with the culture, with personal things in their background and so on, which is kind of usual thing we do as analysts, of course. But I'm also very attentive to listen to how the meaning they give to their experience. And to try to catch the cultural meaning. What is the meaning when you lose a person, when somebody dies, for example? How is it when somebody dies in your home country when you are in exile, for example? How do you mourn? What is possible ways of mourning a person who has disappeared and you don't know where the person is buried, for example? So all these things you have to be quite sensitive to, and also inquire your patients about the ways and of being and the ways of understanding things from their own cultural background. So it's not talking about culture; it's more like to be sensitive to be and try to use your imagination as an analyst to sense what is the cultural context here.
You have written about and emphasized the presence of survivor guilt. Can you share with us how that shows up and how you help individuals with that?
Well, in my experience, and I think many others, the survivor guilt, and as was really good described by Nederland, is present in almost all the cases. It may not be very obvious, but it is there. I think you can, as a therapist, you can be sure that there is present in some way, and sometimes it's defining for the life of people. So I have several patients who has spent most of their time in life to help others, for example. A woman who lost her child, she was quite exhausted. She had to help others all the time, in the weekends, to help people from her own country, helping them in the night and so on. And what helped her was that she gradually managed to talk about and symbolize what happened when her child died, and to mourn the loss. And I think the mourning process was the key factor that helped her to start to live a kind of more normal life not exhausting herself or helping others.
Mm-hmm.
And I have seen similar things in other patients. And they have guilt feelings. They have feel really that I have a good reason to feel guilt. I should actually not be here. I should have been killed myself. Or different forms, different situation, of course. But many have lost people, and they feel they should have done something. They should have done things that is impossible. That was impossible to do, as ordinary parents, of course, would think when a child dies. So I think what helps with the survivor guilt is to help them to realize the roots of the guilt and to help them in the process of mourning, I think. Say it quite kind of simple.
And when you say the roots of the guilt, you're referring now back to childhood antecedents to the later guilt?
Well, I think most have these clear experiences during traumatization. That, for example, this lady who lost her child, it was after she was imprisoned and maltreated in prison while being pregnant, and then had to live clandestinely, and her child was ill, and she couldn't get any medical help for the child, and the child died in her arms. So it was real experiences. Others have experienced that their friends in the prison were killed while they was not killed, and so on. But of course, it attaches to earlier experiences as well. Mm.
Not to say that one needs earlier experiences to be overwhelmed by such traumas. I didn't mean to imply that in any way at all. But let me ask you something. You hear about these horrible situations that these individuals go through, and you are asked to sit with it. And we invite these individuals to share as openly as they can with us. But you also hear about perpetrators. And as I'm listening to you now, and you're giving just these little snapshots of horrible situations, you, I imagine, also picture the people doing it. Now, they're not in our office, I understand that. But they are in the human family in some way. What's that like for you, to know that people intentionally cause this degree of horror on our fellow human beings?
Well, in a way, that's really a difficult part, and it's what follows me most outside the therapy room, in a way. And I think that listening to patients talking about these perpetrators and what they have been doing and able to do is one of the more difficult parts. And which follows me more outside the therapy room than actually listening to the suffering of the patient. And of course, it involves sometimes quite strong aggression, but also repulsion. And it makes it difficult for me to follow the news, for example, of what is happening in Ukraine, what the Russian soldiers are doing, raping women, killing children, and things like that. It's makes it difficult to really trust in humanity that things like this is possible, and I have to realize is possible. People can be so cruel like this, and then I try to understand to a certain degree why it may be like this, but it's difficult. It's really difficult.
Do you end up, I'm imagining myself, and I don't know what it would be like to do the work you're describing, but do you end up in a sort of cloud about this human condition, that people can do this thing to other people and then go home to their families and go to their churches or mosques and have celebrations and yet go to work and torture people like this on an ongoing basis?
Yes, it is a kind of foggy, and I must admit I have to struggle with with the disillusionment, that and the kind of disappointment, to put it very simple. On the other hand, it becomes then even more important to take care of, in my personal life and with my friends and things like that, what is good about humanity. But it's impossible to understand how people can do things like this.
And your work is devoted to making some contribution to remedying the soiling of the human experience.
Yes, well, that's a hope, and my contribution is extremely modest in this direction. But I was involved in human rights works very directly in the Balkans and in Turkey, for example, trying to help people, so to speak, speak and have a dialogue again after the terrible wars in the Balkans in the 90s. But of course, it's you can do something, but it's quite modest. But I hope that if many people are working along the same lines, maybe it will have some effect.
You use the word rehumanization to describe your therapeutic efforts with these individuals, and that comes across in your work. But there's also something in you to find pleasures and meaning and satisfaction in the work.
Yeah. Well, it's I think every encounter with a patient is a potential rehumanizing experience, and also for me as a therapist, because when we are slowly experiencing this kind of positive emotion in the therapy, especially when it comes to turning points, where the patient suddenly realizes that it is possible to trust another human being, that's a really remarkable experience with these patients who have all reasons to not believe that it is possible to trust other people, who have been disappointed, who have been failed so many times and maltreated so many times. So that is a rehumanizing experience that happens, I think, between the therapist and the patient. It's really, I think that's the best way to describe the process of positive outcome of this type of psychoanalytic therapy, because these people have been dehumanized. They've been dehumanized in so many ways and to such a degree that it's for some of them it's a wonder that they have normal feelings left.
Can you tell us about yourself? I mean, your work is so richly described, and I do recommend your book, your many, many books, and your papers on the subject. But we have an opportunity now to get to know you, the man who has devoted himself to this. Can you share with us what brings you here?
Well, that's, of course, a very difficult question. And it has to do with my background, my childhood upbringing, and so on. But also before that, I am a so-called after the war child, and growing up in Norway after the Germans left, and my father was fighting in the war, and my mother come from another country because of the circumstances. And I must admit that I did have a really difficult childhood, especially with mother, who was really experiencing the difficulties of being exiled, even if she was not a refugee in that way. And then some early traumatic experiences with hospitalization and so on. And of course, I didn't understand this was traumatic until I went to do an analysis. I was greatly helped in my two psychoanalysis with these things, and came to terms with life, I think. But it left me with a constant urge to understand people who were really on the side, or who was kind of feeling a lion in relation to society. That was, it urged me very much. I was so occupied with psychoanalysis, but at the same time, I needed to understand how the culture, the social circumstances impinged on the mind, and also defined how people were living their lives.
Well, you're certainly making a contribution in both those areas. Let me go from there to ask you a bit about the Norwegian Psychoanalytic Society. Some of our listeners may be familiar, many will not. Can you give us a snapshot of your society? And then I want to talk about what you're doing, either you and or the community is doing in relation to the Ukraine crisis.
Well, the Norwegian society has an interesting history. Very shortly, it was founded in 1934 as a group of psychoanalysts in Norway and Sweden, and also one in Denmark. They formed a kind of Scandinavian psychoanalytic group, which was accepted by the IPA in the 1930s. When the Norway was occupied by the Germans, the people from this Göring Institute in Berlin, that was kind of Nazi version of a psychotherapeutic mm-hmm. institute, they attempted to include the Norwegian group in this new way of thinking psychoanalysis or psychotherapy. All the members of the group, they were active in the resistance, and they dissolved the group and went into resistance, and some also died, some were put into concentration camps, and so on. So then after the war, it was a group who had experienced quite a lot. And then the Norwegian group was not accepted by the IPA. It was excluded for. They applied, like many other societies in Europe, that now we want to reorganize and become a member of the IPA. And then they were denied. And the reasons were not very explicit.
And there's something about they applied to the IPA and they were turned down initially. Is that right?
Yes. And there was no explicit reason given, and it has been done research to find out why what was the reason. But I think it was a great suspicion in the IPA in London, because Wilhelm Reich had been a refugee in Norway in the 30s and had some kind of pupils in the Norwegian group. So I think they were afraid that the influence on Wilhelm Reich would make bad psychoanalysis in Norway. It was very strange, actually. Otto Fenichel, he was also a refugee in Norway and also a secretary of the group in the 1930s. But to make it short, it took until 1985 before the Norwegian group again was a member society in the IPA. It's not a nice.
And there are how many members and candidates?
Now, I think we are around 100 members and 90 candidates or something like that. It's quite.
I see.
It's a good group. It's a growing. It's a growing group, and it's functioning quite well.
And tell us, I know you've been involved with trying to do something with Ukrainian colleagues and refugees. Can you share with us what that's been?
Well, I have been worked with the Ukrainian organization in Norway to try to create a group of therapists, analysts, who were willing to give therapy for free for Ukrainians, Ukrainian refugees coming to Norway. So we have now a group of around 25 to 30 therapists. And Ukrainian refugees who have mental problems, they can be referred for crisis interventions, for family therapy, for group therapy, and also individual therapy. So it's...
And this is provided by this, by the society? By members of
by
the society?
By members of the society. So it's the society is, of course, approves this and stand behind us in this effort. But it's the individual members who are providing this this therapy for free.
And these are for refugees in Norway, or it's online with refugees in or and around Ukraine?
This is for refugees in Norway, but it can also can be online because Norway is a very long country, so it's long distances here. But we are also trying to now organizing supervisions for therapists working in Ukraine. There are that's members of the Ukrainian psychoanalytic study group. Are organizing in Kharkiv, in the eastern part of Ukraine, a clinic for mostly for soldiers. And they want to have supervision for their work, and then we are now trying to organize this supervision, especially with a colleague from Belgrade, Vladimir Jovic, which you may know.
Yes. Yes, he and I had a conversation a while ago. And what do you do as far as language goes? I assume many of the Norwegians don't speak Ukrainian, yeah?
Well, first, we do have members in our society from the Baltic states who speak Russian. So we can provide therapists who, in fact, they have Russian as one of their primary languages without being Russians, of course. This is important. But then we have to rely on interpreters. And this is something that has to be built up. So my university, they are training interpreters for this purpose for you in Ukrainian language. And it's very sensitive, of course, with the Russians.
Yes, you make the point that these are non-Russian speakers of the Russian language, but they're not Russian nationals, with the sense that even if they were sympathetic to Ukrainian cause and freedom, that they might be Russian themselves makes it too much to work with Ukrainian refugees. Is that a fair understanding?
And I think... we should not push this now. It will take quite a long time before Ukrainian and Russian colleagues, for example, can talk together properly. And also Ukrainian patients can meet Russian, even if the person is very sympathetic and so on. I think this will be a complicated process. It takes time.
Yes, that was a point that Mira Ehrlich made in my conversation. She, from Israel, is working with many Ukrainian colleagues and has noted the same point, that this isn't the time to work at integrating the two communities. Sfera, I want to thank you. I feel I've gotten to know you in both reading your work and hearing you relate what your involvement in this work is. It's so powerful. It's so delicate at the same time. it's so nuanced and it's so transformative. I mean, you speak of, and we clinicians who are listening to this are aware of what you say about how every clinical encounter rehumanizes us in some unique way. But in addition to that, what you're doing is something more. It's something further. The rehumanization that you are witnessing and participating in and co-creating by your work is of a different sort than the patients we generally see, though those of us who see some early trauma do very much know what you're speaking of, but that you live with people recounting these most horrific, purposely caused violences on our fellow humans is something. And I want to thank you for sharing your not only your work but your heart with us, because I can feel that. And I'd want to mention that you will be a keynote speaker at the IPA meetings in Cartagena in July 2023. And for those who want to not only read your book but to hear you speak, I recommend they attend for that. Thank you for spending time with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much for listening. It's been a good conversation. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org. We can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.